Well, welcome to the Epic Podcast, and this is episode 16, and today we're going to cover 1 Samuel 9 to 22. In our previous episode, Hannah showed us that our barren womb takes us to the altar of prayer. Our breakthrough and God's answer is about heaven and earth aligning, when our desire comes into sync with His plan for the world. We were also left standing with the Israelites, waiting for the king everyone demanded. Hannah's son, born from her barren womb, Samuel, was attested by God throughout Israel as someone who heard his voice and spoke his word. But now Samuel was getting too old to lead Israel. Since his sons were corrupt, the Israelites were feeling insecure about their future. There would always be battles to fight, and the Philistines were hot on their heels. It was unanimous that if they had a king, like all the other nations, someone tangible who could lead them and their army, they would be safe, or so they thought. The story of Saul and David, both anointed by Samuel to be kings of Israel, became the backdrop for a deeply personal lesson God was teaching me about destiny, identity, and confronting the high wall of my inner critic. Samuel himself was the answer to Hannah's desperate cry for a child, but he was also God's strategic plan to birth a prophet who would call out the destinies of kings and restore Israel's identity. He would intercede for the nation, face the Philistines, and bring back the Ark, the presence of God. While I was writing Crossing the Jordan River, Samuel became a picture of the prophetic voice that calls forth the king within us and reveals our true identity in God. Through that season of weeping, God began to show me that what was being birthed through my own life would be used by Him to call out destiny, not only in myself, but in others as well. Samuel was the last judge of Israel, bridging the time between the era of judges and the establishment of the monarchy that would usher in the new chapter of leadership on the blueprint of God's plan. God specifically instructs him who to anoint as Israel's new king and how to go about it. This next section in the book of 1 Samuel we are covering today introduces the new era of leadership in Israel. Just as Moses led Israel out of Egypt, and Joshua led the next generation into the promised land, and then the judges rule, now the kings will rule, all the way through to the exile of Judah into Babylon. But I want to fast forward a little to give you an important overview that will help you wrap your head around this next story. This new era spans a period of about 120 years. It is broken into three sections of 40, each representing the reign of one of the next three kings. First Saul, then David, and finally Solomon, before the kingdom begins to unravel. After they ruled, the kingdom of Israel splits into two groups. 10 tribes move north and are called Israel, and 2 tribes, one of which is the royal bloodline of Jesus, Judah, and the tribe of Benjamin, together with the Levitical priests, stay in the south. These 2 sides are often at war against each other and never reunite as 12 tribes, but we will get into this later. What is important now is that Samuel will anoint Israel's first king, Saul. You will see that his 40-year reign represents a worldly king, one who rules from the flesh. In the natural, he embodies all the characteristics that make him the popular people's choice, but eventually pride leads his heart. Saul is a Benjamite from the youngest and weakest tribe of Jacob's sons. We could almost imagine that he represents us when we operate in fear of man. This is when our flesh rules us, rather than a heart that is surrendered to God. This is when we are striving and operating independently from God. Early in the years of Saul's rule, God tells Samuel to anoint Israel's second king, David, who comes from the tribe of Judah. He is a king that God chooses for Israel, an unlikely candidate, one that society would easily pass over, but God looks at the heart. You'll see that his 40-year reign represents a king, although flawed, who rules from a heart that is devoted to God. King David is also the bloodline of Jesus. We need to remember that up until this point in Israel's history, God was their king. He would use a prophet to speak to his people or raise up a leader to deliver and guide them in battle. But now, Israel is about to become a kingdom, a monarchy ruled by an earthly king who is unlike God and who is human after all. As we've established, God has a blueprint, and he is always moving the pawns around on the chessboard to set up the circumstances for his purpose. Saul was a tall, handsome young man from a high society family in the tribe of Benjamin. Truly, folks, 1 Samuel 9:2 says, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites, a head taller than any of the others. In my own journey as an artist, I have fallen in line with the likes of the Israelites. For so long, I was running after an agent, a gallery owner, anyone really that would validate my work and make it happen for me. I realized that this pursuit ran as a river of troubled water, deeper than I realized. We all want to be approved, accepted. So we hanker after souls to pat us on the back. We value what and who looks successful, and anyone who has it all together must be right. But before I get carried away, let us look into how God sets up the circumstances for Saul. One day, Saul's father Kish lost some donkeys, so he sent Saul and a servant to search for them. They traveled through various regions, but couldn't find them anyway. As they neared the land of Zuph, Saul was ready to give up, but his servant suggested they enter a nearby town and visit a man of God, what they called a seer at the time, a type of future teller, but one operating in the Spirit of God. Saul hesitated. They had no gift to give the prophet, as was custom, but his companion coughed up a coin and convinced him to go. Now listen to this. Samuel the prophet happened to be there. 1 Samuel 9 verse 16 says, about this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him ruler over my people Israel. He will deliver them from the land of the Philistines. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me. Then verse 17 says, when Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, this is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people. And just before that, in verse 14, they went up to the town, and as they were entering it, there was Samuel coming toward them on his way up to the high place. But of course, Saul did not know who Samuel was. Verse 18, Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and asked, would you please tell me where the seer's house is? I hope by now you're convinced that coincidence really is a fallacy. Samuel said, I'm the one you're looking for. He invited Saul to dinner and gave him the place of honor amongst his guests. Then he said, in the morning, I will send you on your way, and I will tell you all that is in your heart. As for the donkeys you lost 3 days ago, do not worry about them. They have been found. Good heavens, imagine that. You're in dire straits. Your father is desperate for you to find his donkeys. After 3 days, you've lost all hope. Then you take a chance on a seer, and the very man you need to speak to walks straight up to you, invites you as an honest guest to the table, gives you the best food, and tells you that the donkeys have been found. And the cherry on the top, he calls for the special portion of meat he had already set aside for you. Just for you. He knew you were coming. Folks, when God has decided you have to do something for him, he makes it happen without you having to fret and strive. He will set up the circumstances for his blueprint to unfold. The next morning, Samuel privately spoke to Saul and revealed God's plan for his life, what we would call today a prophetic word. They were alone on the roof when Samuel poured oil on Saul's head, anointed him, and told him that God had chosen him to lead Israel. Then Samuel gave him 3 prophetic signs to confirm his calling, of which one was, you will meet a group of prophets. The Spirit of the Lord will come powerfully upon you, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person. Once these signs are fulfilled, do whatever your hands find to do, for God is with you. Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do. As Saul left Samuel, God changed his heart, and all 3 signs were fulfilled. Friends, I want to jump in here quickly. If there's really one precious piece of treasure I can share with you today, it is this. When we receive prophetic words over our lives, these words are there to encourage us and to open our minds to the potential God sees in our lives. It is possible that it awakens us to something that we had not been thinking about, but the truth is our spirit will identify with it if it truly is from God. Luke 1 tells us, when Mary, pregnant with Jesus, visits her cousin Elizabeth, who is carrying John the Baptist, John leaps in Elizabeth's womb at the sound of Mary's greeting. This passage highlights John's prophetic role even before birth, as he responds to the presence of the Messiah. Our womb of purpose will surely skip a beat when we recognize our divine calling. It is not our responsibility to make it happen. The unfolding of the prophetic word is completely up to God. It is a work of grace. We've already seen this at the beginning of this podcast series in the stories of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Rachel. For prophecy never had its origin in the human will, but prophets, though human, spoke from God as they were carried along by the Holy Spirit. This reinforces that prophecy is God-ordained, not something we can achieve through striving. But Scripture does tell us in 1 Timothy 1:18, recall the prophecies once spoken over you, so that by them you may fight the good fight. A prophetic word will also build us up and give us hope, giving us something to press into and thresh with God. When heaven seems silent and we've hit a dead end, we are not empty-handed. God has given us strategy to fight in the Spirit using the words He has already spoken over our lives and our destinies. Now Samuel gave Saul one clear instruction when he anointed him. He told him to wait in Gilgal for 7 days until Samuel met him there. This is important because the future of Saul's reign and kingdom would hinge on obeying this one request. Samuel summoned the people of Israel to the Lord at Mizpah to publicly choose their king. He said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought Israel up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the power of Egypt and all the kingdoms that oppressed you. But you have now rejected your God, who saved you out of all your disasters and calamities, and you have said, 'No, appoint a king over us.' So now present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and clans." The selection process eventually led to Saul from the tribe of Benjamin. When he was brought forward, the people saw his impressive stature and shouted in approval, accepting him as their king. Then everyone returned home satisfied, and Saul returned to his home in Gibeah, accompanied by some men whose hearts had been touched by God. Meanwhile, God, still at work orchestrating, sets up the next set of events. Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, besieged Jabes Gilead, a Benjamite city, and demanded a humiliating surrender. He would only make peace if they could gouge out the right eye of every man in the city. Remember how we discussed the Ammonites' tactics back in Judges when we spoke about Jephthah. The elders of Jabesh asked for 7 days to find help. If no one would come, they would then surrender. In this way, God sets up the circumstances for Saul to be recognized by Israel as a valiant king, and everything was aligned. Messengers rushed to the nearest town, Gibeah, where Saul lived. When Saul heard the news, the Spirit of God came upon him, and he burned with righteous anger. He took 2 oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent them throughout Israel with this message: anyone who refused to join the fight would suffer the same fate as the oxen. The fear of the Lord fell on the people, and 330,000 men gathered to fight. Saul led the army to Jabesh Gilead and launched a surprise attack at dawn. The Ammonites were completely defeated and the city was saved. To celebrate, Samuel led the people to Gilgal, where they officially confirmed Saul as their king and offered sacrifices to God. Remember, Gilgal was the camp where the new generation of Israelites camped once they had entered the promised land with Joshua. It was the place where they were circumcised before they began possessing the land and facing the giants. One could almost say that this next era of kingdom had its launch in Gilgal, just as the generation of Joshua did. Now that Saul was king, he had a few serious battles to face because Israel had not yet driven out all the enemies in the land of Canaan. The 2 main threats at this stage were the Philistines and the Amalekites. We spoke about their tactics and character in the episodes of the Judges. So the first important battle Saul faced was against the Philistines at Gibeah. Saul had been king for a while when his son Jonathan attacked a Philistine outpost in Gibeah. Jonathan had more faith in his father. He wasn't going to sit around or stand for any nonsense. He was full of conviction that the God of Israel would help him. We could imagine that he too, like David, grew up with the stories of the heroes of old, the likes of Joshua and Caleb. The Philistines retaliated with a massive army, including 3,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. The Israelites lost their nerve, many hid in caves, while others fled east across the Jordan River. After Saul called all of Israel to arms, they gathered and waited at Gilgal for 7 days, expecting Samuel to arrive and offer sacrifices before the battle. But now even the troops began to scatter in fear. Saul took matters into his own hands and offered the burnt offering himself, something only a prophet or priest was allowed to do. Just as Saul finished, Samuel arrived and confronted him. Saul tried to justify his actions, saying he was afraid of losing his army and needed God's favor. But Samuel rebuked him. "You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. Because of this disobedience, God will take the kingdom away from you and give it to a man after his own heart." This prophecy would later be fulfilled by David. The second major battle Saul faced was against the Philistines at Michmash. Once again, his son Jonathan was the one who had the courage to make the first move and declared, "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." Only Jonathan and his armor-bearer went up toward the enemy line, while Saul, his priest, and the army were hanging back on the outskirts, complacent and reluctant to challenge the status quo, totally unaware of what Jonathan was up to. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor-bearer killed about 20 men. Then panic struck the whole Philistine army, those in the camp and the field, the outposts and the raiding parties. Literally everywhere there were Philistines. Even the ground shook. It was clearly a panic sent by God. Saul's watchmen saw the Philistines scattering in all directions, realizing something was happening. Saul gathered his troops and told the priest to bring the Ark of God. But while they were speaking, the chaos and pandemonium escalated. There was no time to fetch the Ark. They had to act now. When they arrived, the Philistines were so disorientated that they were attacking each other. The Hebrews who had been living amongst the Philistines switched sides and joined Saul's forces. More Israelites, hearing about the battle, came to fight as well. At the end of the day, the Lord saved Israel. The third battle Saul had to face was against the Amalekites. Do you remember we spoke about this enemy in the story of Moses? They are the ones that attacked the weak and the weary Israelites at the back of the pack once they had escaped Egypt. After Israel's victory against the Amalekites in the wilderness, God declared he would completely blot them out, and now he was instructing Saul to finish the job. He told Saul to destroy the Amalekites completely, including the people and their livestock. But instead of fully obeying, he spared their king Agag. Then he kept the best sheep and cattle, claiming that he would use it for sacrifices. When Saul saw the prophet Samuel approaching, he actually bragged about what he had done. "The Lord bless you, Samuel. I have carried out the Lord's instructions." But Samuel replied, "Enough. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying, 'Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you have wiped them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" And then he said this unforgettable word, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry." Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." Samuel then executed King Agag himself. From that day forward, Samuel never saw Saul again, though he mourned for him. Is it possible for us to mess up the prophetic word over our life? Well, I believe the answer is yes, when we act independently from God. It does not mean that we are a lost cause. God is slow to anger and quick to forgive, which we will see later in the story of David. When we truly turn our hearts back to God, his grace covers us and works it all out. Unlike David, who runs to God when he has messed up, Saul is arrogant and tries to justify his actions. Saul was anointed, chosen, empowered, yet from the very beginning he was deeply afraid. Afraid of people's opinions, afraid of being replaced, afraid that God would move on without him. Fear became the lens through which he saw leadership, and it poisoned his ability to trust God. Instead of resting in God's favor, Saul strove to secure his position through control. I've shared before about my own journey, how I cried out to God for breakthrough in my creativity and for a voice of my own, and how I threw myself into the Word of God, threshing for treasure. Now let me introduce you to David, a character whose story taught me so much about leaving my destiny up to God. His journey is a perfect example of how to steward our prophetic words and wait for God to open the doors for us and promote us. David himself wrote in Psalm 31, the Passion Translation, "My life, my every moment, my destiny, it's all in your hands. So I know you can deliver me from those who persecute me relentlessly." Another verse is in Psalm 16:5. "Lord, I have chosen you alone as my inheritance. You are my prize, my pleasure, and my portion. I leave my destiny and its timing in your hands." He was a young shepherd boy from the tribe of Judah, the eighth son in his family, and probably considered the runt by his brothers. They were real men, fighting real battles in Saul's army, while David was assigned the domestic duty of tending sheep. We could easily call him a nobody, spending hours on his own, day in and day out, going through the same routine of chores and general mundanity. But David loved the Lord with all his heart, and he loved to worship. God had given him a creative gift, and David lavished it on his relationship with God. And God loved those moments, being glorified, blessed and loved on by the young heart that truly was his. David admired his brothers, and I'm sure he spent many an afternoon role-playing their valiant battles. He was a warrior at heart. 1 Samuel 17 tells us that he too was strengthened on the job. When a lion or a bear attacked his flock, he chased it down, struck it, and rescued the sheep. If the animal turned on him, he grabbed it by the mane and killed it. God said to Samuel, soon after Samuel had told Saul he would lose the kingdom, "Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice and I will show you what to do. You are to anoint for me the one I indicate." So Samuel did what the Lord said. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the elders of the town trembled when they met him. They asked, "Do you come in peace?" Samuel replied, "Yes, in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come to the sacrifice with me." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Even Samuel judged by appearances. He would never have considered David if God hadn't intervened. Jesse had 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, "The Lord has not chosen these." So he asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" David hadn't even been considered by his father or brothers. "There is still the youngest," Jesse answered. "He is tending the sheep." As soon as David arrived, God confirmed he was the one. Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the presence of his brothers, and from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully on David. No one said anything but kept the matter to themselves. While Saul was unraveling on the throne, God was quietly preparing a man after his own heart in the pasture fields. David wasn't striving for the crown. He was simply being faithful with the sheep, learning to lead through worship, through waiting, through watching over what belonged to someone else. In the meantime, because of Saul's pride and rebellion, the Spirit of the Lord left him, and God allowed an evil spirit to torment him. Everyone was at their wits' ends. His servant suggested finding someone who could play the harp to soothe him. Now listen to this, and see how busy God was, as always, in the background. David's creative gift, something he did in his spare time, not as a vocation, the fact that he could play the harp became his way into the palace. It was his hall pass, so to speak, his open door. The reputation he had for being both a skilled musician and a man of God gave him access to King Saul, and this seemingly small detail would soon set him up for his next breakthrough, his encounter with Goliath. Once again, the Philistines and Israelites were at war. This time, the armies camped on opposite hills in the valley of Elah, where so many battles had drawn their line. The Philistines were renowned for boasting and mocking, so their champion, Goliath, a giant warrior from Gath, standing over 9 feet tall, was having a field day. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand, relentlessly intimidating and humiliating Saul and his men. He wore a heavy armor and carried a massive spear. One could say, if you had to sum up the Philistines in a nutshell, Goliath would be the word. No one dared face him, not even King Saul. As always, there were many players and moves involved in God's chessboard, each played with extreme precision and strategy. While all this was going on with Goliath, David's father Jesse sent him to the camp with food for his brothers. When he got there, David heard Goliath's challenge and was outraged that no one was standing up to him. He didn't even think twice before declaring that he could do it. What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David's oldest brother heard him speaking with the men. He burned with anger and he asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom do you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." His brothers were fraught with jealousy. David's faith was showing them up, and instead of supporting him, they knocked him down with their words. But for David, it was like water off a duck's back. He listened to what the other men were saying. "The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." Saul got wind of it and sent for David. Even though David was just a boy, he had already built up some credibility with Saul, since he had played the harp for Saul's tormented soul. I'm sure it helped convince the king perhaps this young man could do it. David told him about all the wild animals he had single-handedly managed to fight off. Saul agreed and tried to give David his armor, but David refused, choosing instead his sling and 5 smooth stones. Can you imagine this playing out, a young boy with a sling, face to face with a mammoth? I imagine it was like a WWE match, the Philistines erupting into a cacophony of stomping and jeering, Goliath playing to his audience, lifting his hands as if absorbing their energy, flexing and pounding his chest, pointing straight at the Israelites and bellowing, "Send me your strongest. Send me your bravest, and I will send him back in pieces." The laughter echoed across the valley, their confidence swelling in every word. Then there was movement. A single figure stepped onto the battlefield, a midget in comparison, not even a man yet. David. Goliath saw that David was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and immediately despised him. I'm sure he felt insulted and said, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? Come here, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." But David piped up, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it's not by the sword or spear that the Lord says, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." David slung a stone, hitting Goliath in the forehead. The giant fell face down, and David ran forward, took Goliath's sword, and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they fled. Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued them. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. He put the weapons in his own tent. After that, Saul spoke to David and Jonathan. Saul's son Jonathan became deeply bonded to David like a brother. Scripture says they became one in spirit, and he loved David as himself. Jonathan even gave David his robe, sword, bow, and belt, showing his trust and support. David could have blurted out the fact that God had anointed him and that he was destined to be the next king. Anyone else might have carried those credentials proudly, or at least hinted at them. But we will witness that David stewards those prophetic words with tremendous humility and patience. He knew that if God intended him to be king, he would do it when the time was right. In the meantime, he would, like Joseph, wait for his destiny to unfold. David continued to succeed in everything Saul assigned him to do, and soon everyone admired him even more than Saul. Saul's heart began to change towards David as jealousy started to throttle him. He knew his time on the throne was running out. Deep in his being, he felt insecure because God had warned that he would take the kingdom away and give it to another, even though Saul didn't want to admit it. From that moment on, Saul watched David closely. Folks, it's interesting that Saul never aspired to be king, but God stepped in and made it all happen. He would have, could have, had it all, but his own disobedience and pride dragged him into a pit of self-pity and insecurity. Instead of honoring God and remaining contrite, he began to try and control anything that might threaten his standing. Saul then tried to remove David by sending him into battle, hoping he would be killed. But David continued to succeed, and the people loved him even more. The counterfeit will always feel threatened when the authentic walks into the room. Saul saw in David what he had fortified: purity of heart, intimacy with God, a calling unattained by fear, and it terrified him. Saul offered his eldest daughter Merah to be David's wife after slaying Goliath, but he humbly declined. But now Saul saw that his daughter Michal was smitten with David and thought that if he offered her to him in marriage, he might be able to trap him. He had noticed the secret glances between them. But David wasn't going to marry her without paying a price. I'm sure something in his spirit warned him that if he didn't pay, he would always be indebted to Saul, so to speak. Saul appealed to David's passion, Philistines. Folks, notice the tactic of the enemy here. Saul appeals to David's passion, which is fighting the battles for the Lord and destroying those uncircumcised Philistines. No opposition has been able to get the better of David yet, because his strength is in the Lord. So the enemy's strategy changes. He will attempt to use what you love most, what you are most passionate about, to get you under his control. We are flattered when someone notices our passion, and we need to take every partnership to the Lord. Ask him to protect us from something that might want to control us and ensnare us. Weigh everything up with the Lord and discern whether it truly is beneficial or not. So it was agreed that David could have her if he brought Saul the foreskins of 100 Philistines. Saul was convinced David would die trying. Michal was attractive. Her subtle flirtation had not gone unnoticed, and her beauty made David's heart skip a beat every time she walked in the room. Not only did David kill 100 Philistines, but he slaughtered 200 for her. So David and Michal were married. Now Jonathan and he were truly brothers, joined at the hip. Saul's plan was failing. Even his daughter's heart was leaving his and clinging to his arch enemy. One day, while David was playing the lyre and Saul was prophesying, an evil spirit came upon him, and he hurled a spear at David, trying to kill him. Fortunately, David managed to get away, but he was on high alert. The enemy always rises up just as your destiny begins to emerge. Saul didn't just want David dead. He wanted to destroy what David represented, the threat of a new kingdom, the kingdom of the spirit, the kingdom of the heart. That night, David lay in bed, not knowing that by morning he would be running for his life, not knowing that everything familiar, his home, his position, even his marriage, was about to be stripped away. But sometimes the path to kingship begins with exile. How far would Saul go to protect his throne, even though he knew he had already lost it? And how does God unravel the story and ensure his blueprint is established? Well, folks, we'll have to wait until the next episode to see how it all unfolds. In the meantime, please share these episodes with your friends and family. Let's work together to spread the word of God and reignite a passion for the powerful, often overlooked stories of the Old Testament. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Epic Podcast on YouTube, a chronological and visual journey through the Old Testament. You can find me under Michelle Neathling 6170, the Epic Podcast. You can also follow me on social media, Facebook, Michelle Neathling Art, Instagram, Michelle Neathling Art. And remember, that's Michelle with just one L. Check out my website, intuitiveprophetic.art.co.za. If you'd like a beautiful hardcover edition of my book, The Epic, a chronological and visual guide through the Old Testament, you can order directly from me at michellenethlingart@gmail.com. Both books, Crossing the Jordan River and The Epic, are available on Takealot South Africa and soon to be on Amazon internationally.